Good morning. On Wednesday afternoon, Taoiseach Micheál Martin spoke in the Dáil on the publication of the final report of the Commission of Investigation into mother and baby homes.
And so on behalf of the government, the state and its citizens, I apologise for the profound generational wrong visited upon Irish mothers and their children who ended up in a mother and baby home or a county home. As the Commission says plainly, they should not have been there. I apologise for the shame and stigma which they were subjected to and which for some remains a burden to this day. In apologising, I want to emphasise that each of you were in an institution because of the wrongs of others. Each of you is blameless. Each of you did nothing wrong and has nothing to be ashamed of. Each of you deserved so much better.
That apology followed a five-year investigation into the lives of women and children in 14 mother and baby homes and four county homes during the period of 1922 to 1998. 56,000 women and girls were sent to these institutions. 57,000 babies were born and 9,000 died when they were infants, and where many of them are buried is not known. Misogyny by church and state under the tyrannical guise of respectability had created a cruel Ireland for women and their children, with shame, silence and secrecy dominating lives. Catherine Corliss was the historian whose work so many years ago on infant deaths and the burial ground of the Bonsecours sisters-run mother and baby home in Tuam had led to this commission of inquiry. Before the report was released to the wider public, the government held a webinar with some of the women and children from the homes and campaigners, including Catherine Corliss. Afterwards, she gave her reaction on Drive Time.
Well, I must say it was one of disappointment, and I speak on behalf of survivors as well, who I've been speaking to in the meantime. Now, I didn't have a chance yet to look at the full report, and I'm hoping we'll get a bit more solace when we read that. Mm-hmm. But as regards the webinar, there isn't a lot in it for us, really. They mentioned a lot of statistics, and we know that already. We know the stories of survivors. They know their own stories, and we know what went on. It was basically a lot of that was covered. But what wasn't covered was anything to do with about illegal adoptions. That was more or less skimmed over, and we would like more detail on that. And also, as well as that, and particularly for myself, we need to know what happened in as regards all the deaths. What is the full report going to show why so many babies died, and what were the conditions, and how did the burials take place, and as regards to them, who was responsible for discarding the little babies and toddlers in a sewage area. Mm-hmm. We need answers to that. And as well, we would like an apology from the religious and from the church, because a lot of the blame has been put on society, and it's been emphasised over and over again by the Taoiseach. And he is evading questions as regards apology from elsewhere. I will say that a lot of the webinar today was there was some whitewash and there was political jargon. We need to understand what they said.
Many survivors took issue with the report. Its leaking last weekend, its distribution or lack thereof, the timing of the apology, and more than anything else, the report's findings that there was no evidence that adoptions had been forced. And in particular, the idea that responsibility lay with society at large. On Wednesday, Audrey Carvel on Morning Ireland spoke to Mary Steed, who was born in Bessborough, a mother and baby home in Cork, and Teresa O'Sullivan, who'd been born in Tuam, and asked them for their reaction to the report.
Well, I'm very disappointed in it, to say the least. It's a shambolic exercise. It really is. I think the primary problem with it is trying to foist blame directly on society and away from the state and the religious orders. I think that kind of rings through very clear, as well as in some of the opening remarks that the Taoiseach made to us yesterday during the presentation. And that's, I think, disgraceful. It sets the tone and it sets the narrative. And it appears to me that once again, survivors truly weren't listened to.
Teresa, what are your thoughts on it? My thoughts are that I would certainly agree with some of the content that Mary has said. I think that I have a pain in my heart right now, reflecting back on everything that I have heard yesterday. And Mary is right. We are the experts. It's the survivors are the experts in this. I think the government is making a strong attempt, I have to say, this is my opinion, that they are trying, and I think together we can certainly do something. But the bottom line is, in relation to the society, we are all society, we were all part of it, and now we must be part of the resolution.
And Audrey put this to Mary Steed.
Mary, why do you feel the survivors were not listened to this time round?
Well, I think, you know, if you go through, and of course we haven't done a complete deep dive into the report, and there's certainly much that they have admitted was done incorrectly, the deaths, the treatment of children, the treatment of women, that's certainly all there. But then you'll see comments like there was no evidence of abuse found. Well, if you've got a death rate of 86% in 1 year alone at Bessborough, that constitutes abuse. Somehow those children died, and it wasn't through, you know, sheer luck of the draw. Also, you see comments like the women weren't forced. What choice did they have? If you don't have choice, you're forced. That's a forced adoption by definition. I also, you know, in the lead off to their recommendations, they start with recommending counseling. Well, obviously, you know, people have been traumatized. There is a great need for counseling. But I think when you start with that, what you're saying is you're first of all acknowledging that people that came out of the institutions or were adopted are damaged. And that sends a very negative tone to survivors. So it's these, well, we found this, but no evidence of this statements. It just beggars belief.
And Audrey read from the report and asked Teresa for her view.
Teresa, I want to read the paragraph that the Commission concluded on the issue of forced adoptions, and I'll just get your reaction to it. It says that many of the former residents and lobby groups have suggested that adoption should be renamed forced adoption. The Commission does not agree. The Commission found very little evidence that children were forcibly taken from their mothers. It accepts that the mothers did not have much choice, but that is not the same as forced adoption. Mothers did have time after the initial placement for adoption to reassess the situation. What do you make of that?
Well, I can only talk from my own experience on speaking with my mum. And one of the things from yesterday, as you've said there now, is I honestly don't think that my mum ever knew that after 6 months she could have come back and she could have retracted her what she wrote down and what she signed off on. Absolutely no way did mums at that time know about that. And the reason I'm saying that is that 6 months afterwards, when my mum had left the home in Shum, my mum came back. And this is why I have to hold the accountability of the state and the church to talk to my mum, if she was here today, and say to her that they had a second opportunity to make sure that we were together. And that did not happen a second time. That's survivors speaking from the heart. We are the experts.
Teresa O'Sullivan on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. Later, Claire spoke to Noel Brown, who'd been adopted from Bessborough in 1967 and had given testimony to the Commission. She'd just received the transcript of her interview. However, what she had said did not match the transcript and included gross inaccuracies, including stating that she'd been reared by her birth parents. Not the case.
What I did is I spoke for an hour. As you can see, I'm very, you know, well-versed in talking about my own story. So I spoke for an hour. There was one or two questions asked, some of them inappropriate, but there was not 222 questions asked of me. They listened and then they obviously took some of what I said and shoehorned it into the to fit these questions.
So in the just to be really clear, Noel, in this document that you've got today, there are questions there and your answers are given on paper, but you were never asked those questions when you gave your testimony.
No, I wasn't. But there was a sense, you know, at the time, I felt it was a wasted exercise. I went there to find out if I was a subject of vaccine trials, which they wouldn't investigate on my behalf. I was sent back to Tuzla. But for this to land today with so many inaccuracies on it, and they've made it so difficult for people to access their transcripts, there are so many things that are wrong around when she was admitted to the home, when I left the home. All of these details, as someone who's adopted, who has been fighting for my identity from 2002 to the end of 2019, to have details are really, really important to adopted people. We don't have the privilege of birth information, our birth certs, medical records. So every detail, we know it inside out. These are our stories. We ask that they be transcribed correctly, and mine hasn't. And I don't know how many others haven't. But to also make it so hard for us to access this document to make sure that it was accurately transcribed. I listened to the minister yesterday talking about a survivor-centred approach. This is not a survivor-centred approach. It has never been a survivor-centred approach because they're not listening to us.
And before the programme ended, Claire Byrne read this.
We asked the Commission for a comment on that, and they sent us a one-line statement. They said, the Commission does not propose to respond.
Noel Brown with Claire on Wednesday. And all week long, Liveline, which for so many years had given voice to these women and children, again opened up the phone lines. And each day brought so many stories of loss and pain, none of which were easy to listen to. Here are just some of them. On Monday, Sheila, who'd given testimony to the Commission, spoke about having her baby in St Patrick's on the Navan Road and the cruelties she'd experienced.
I can remember a nun, she was bond secured, and she said to me, now Sheila, she said, don't you ever tell anyone that you are here because you're damaged goods and you'll never, ever, ever be accepted in society. So my advice to you is to never tell anyone at all. And I don't forget that.
Yeah, and you've
now I got a few hidings in there, but you know, I stood up for others. You know, I was always standing up. I still am standing up for the mothers. But
and Sheila, your baby being born then?
Yeah, I was made go around the grounds of St Patrick's for 39 hours when I went into labour, and then they brought me in.
Yeah,
and I was in the height of it. I was having difficulty, you know, with the birth. And
you were very young. You were only 19.
I was
20,
very young. Yeah. I was very naive. I mean, most of the women were naive. God love them.
Yeah.
And as I said, you know, the nun shouting in at me, saying, "Keep your voice down in there." Now, I'm in the height of pain, you know, no medication.
You're in labour.
Yeah, I was in the height of it. And keep your voice down in there, you're lowering the tone of the building. You know, that's what was shouted in at me. And then, eventually, they had to get the doctor because there was difficulty, but the baby came. And anyway, I had a breach in my senses standing up. And I don't forget anything at all. I forget nothing. Yeah. But I know that they destroyed me. And I was hemorrhaging after. I was in an awful way, after that. So with that, when my son came into the world, because he was mixed race, they said to me, oh, what have you got here? What is this? That's what they said. Beautiful baby. And they wouldn't allow me to touch him, look at him. No. No touching, no looking.
Did you hold him?
They wouldn't let me.
Sheila talking to Joe on Monday. And one feature of the report were the many women who had become pregnant as a result of rape. Mary was just 13 when she was raped and became pregnant. She had her baby in Bessborough Mother and Baby Home.
This is 1977, and you're saying your parents, who wanted to keep you, were told categorically that you would not be allowed into the local hospital.
No, under any circumstances. You know, there was constant calls from a priest, from a social worker, you know, not advising or not giving any help to my parents, but telling them that what had to happen and where I had to go. And if at all, that I would have gone there at 4 months pregnant, not at 8 months. But my parents stopped that.
So you were you 8 months when you went? So
I was 8 months pregnant, yes.
And you were taken to Bessbury. You didn't want to go, and your parents didn't want you to go.
No. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was 13, and I'd say the next stage was 19. Yeah. Like, I was like a sore thumb to them. like me hanging around there, like I had no one to talk to. I'll always remember that railing on the way into the home. Like, I mean, I used to walk up and down that every day on my own. But I can remember, like, you know, I asked them, could I talk to my mother? I kept at it.
Okay.
And they allowed my mother to ring me every night at 7 o'clock. And I used to stop myself crying on the phone, not to upset my mother.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's all these little things and little, you know, the psychological and the emotional effect on everybody. You know, it was unfortunate enough that I went into the local hospital, you know, at 3 months, and they thought I had my appendix. It was discovered, actually, that I was pregnant, and it was around the local area, you know, in tick time anyway.
And Mary talked about the relationship with her daughter now.
We met in 2003, and, you know, it was such a joy, you know, to see her, that she was, you know, you'd always go through the stage, was she alive, was she dead, whatever, and just to see her, she was beautiful. But to go back to that, like, you know, you'd have this perception that you can go straight ahead and get on with the situation. You know, you go back to giving birth, you think that, you know, that this is all going to be okay now, that everything will be okay and everything will run smoothly. But that don't happen either. She was reared by parents and good parents and had a different life. But you forget that. And you still have the emotion of, oh, this now, you know, she'll understand and everything will be lovely. But unfortunately, it doesn't happen all the time.
Mary, who had her daughter in 1977. Anne gave testimony to the commission about the birth of her son at St. Patrick's on the Navan Road in 1970.
It's a better
phrase. If you put somebody out of society, isolate them, humiliate them.
Okay, well, that would be wouldn't that be a better word for the commission to use? Effectively forced.
Into
a mother and baby home. Effectively forced.
I was with him for 7 weeks, Joe, and I was very, very bonded with him. Yeah. Very bonded. And I absolutely took to being a mother like a duck to water. It was the happiest I've ever been in my life.
Oh, God.
I was completely, I wasn't just bonded, I'd say I was welded. I loved him bottomlessly. I was with him for 7 weeks. My father, and I'm not saying that my father was a good man, but he was the boss of the family, very much the boss. You didn't argue with him.
And what happened to your baby boy?
He was adopted.
Anne with Joe on Thursday. As far as Helen knows, she was adopted from Temple Hill in Blackrock in Dublin at the age of 6 months.
When I see that photograph of all the cots in the room and the babies crying, that breaks my heart, because I feel the first 6 months of a baby's life is so important, so important, and it puts down a marker for the rest of your life. So I always ask myself, was I the baby who smiled up at people to get attention, or was I the one who cried over and over and over again and was left crying? And I know it has affected my life, and I know that, I know I have two half-brothers and a half-sister out there somewhere.
Okay.
And I'd love to meet them. I have no roots. I have absolutely no roots in my life. I'm not grounded. Never have been. And I feel I'm just a tumbleweed going through life with nothing to ground myself.
And she asked this question.
Where are all the men? Where are all the fathers?
Yeah.
Why are they so silent? Like, do they not want to know what happened to their children? Yeah. Yeah. Or do they not want to contact them? Or have they no love for these children?
Helen on Liveline. Fionn Davenport was born in a mother and baby home in Dublin, and he spoke to Claire Byrne on Wednesday.
I was born in 1968 in St. Patrick's on the Navan Road to a 19-year-old who had arrived there in January of that year and had to sign a document giving me up for adoption almost immediately, and within 2 days of my birth had changed her mind, informed the nun or whoever it was that she had changed her mind, only to be told that she wasn't allowed to change her mind, that she had already signed this document and that it was too late and she was never going to get her baby. And 30 years later, discovered that it was all a lie, that according to the Adoption Act of 1952, she'd had until I was 6 months old to make a final determination on whether she wanted to give me up for adoption or not. So that's all I've been thinking about since last night or since yesterday. And I didn't think I was going to get upset or emotional about it because, like Noelle said, like Anne said, I've heard this before. I read the executive summary and I recognize so much in it. And yet listening to them, I find myself really profoundly moved by the fact that I spent 40 years nearly of my life feeling isolated in my feelings, denied agency about the origins of my birth, where I came from, who my birth mum was, who my birth father was, that any attempts I made when I was younger were stopped at the pass because they weren't allowed to give me the information. And like so many thousands of other adopted children, we were living in a time where you were not encouraged to ask any questions. Move on. That's just the what happened, and now move on. So today it just all floods back, and I find it very, very difficult to process.
Mm-hmm. Fionn Davenport with Claire. And that need and right of people who are adopted to find out who they are and get access to their birth certificate remains outstanding. But unexpectedly, on Wednesday, a statement from the Bonsecours sisters in Toom. Catherine Corliss gave her reaction.
The sisters of Bonsecours say they're deeply sorry for their part in this sorrowful history, that infants and children were buried in a disrespectful and unacceptable way. And they go on to say, we did not live up to our Christianity when running the home. And I have got to say, when I was reading that out in the last hour, I thought about you because I saw you on the 6-1 News last night saying that you felt you had let the survivors down after years of lobbying.
Yes.
Does this change your view? I mean, do you feel some sort of vindication? You must do.
Of course. It's a great relief. And I know that it would mean an awful lot to the survivors who went through the home. That's the one thing they had asked for them to say sorry. One man, he kept saying that, I want to go to the grave and tell my mother that the nuns said they were sorry for what they did to us. And that's how much it meant to them. And that has been my passion for the last few years, just for people to acknowledge and to own up to what happened. And that's all really, that first and foremost, what they wanted. So it means a great deal. And I'm grateful to the Bonsecours sisters for owning up. And hopefully what will follow will, the other institutions, that the people, the nuns who run those orphanages and mother and baby homes, that they will follow suit to admit that they were wrong for dishing out cruelty to these poor people. I know that will be a great relief to them. I'm just really happy with that.
We failed, they say, to respect the inherent dignity of the women and children who came to the home. We failed to offer them the compassion that they so badly needed. We were part of the system in which they suffered hardship, loneliness and terrible hurt. We offer our profound apologies to all the women and children of St. Mary's Mother and Baby Home, to their families and to the people of this country.
Claire with historian and campaigner Catherine Corliss. And finally, The Leap of Faith last night featured a poem from Mary Call, who'd been born in the Castle Pollard Mother and Baby Home in 1962.
Laundry. My grandfather sent everything to the nuns for a thorough cleaning, including my mother. Fervently, they washed every stain away. Hold us up to the light so there's hardly a trace of me left in her or her left in me. Things are forever getting separated in the wash, A fawn silk stocking, a tiny pink sock with no matcher. The price to be paid for getting your laundry done.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. This week saw Ireland top the list for the highest infection rate of COVID-19 in the world. And now one in 67 people in the last 14 days has tested positive for the virus. The pressure on our hospitals is massive, and it's taking its toll on our healthcare workers. One of the worst hit is the University of Limerick Hospital. Senior staff nurse Anne Noonan and a member of the Executive Council of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation spoke on Monday's News at One.
There is over 400 staff out in our hospital, and that has a knock-on effect, Brian, because obviously it's 24-hour care 7 days a week. So a lot of people are actually doing extra shifts and are changing their shifts to try and cover. We have a lot of experienced staff, but we also have a lot of new staff. Thankfully, we're very thankful for the international nurses that we have, and we have a lot of them that have started in the last couple of months. They are not used to our systems, and it is very difficult for them outside of pandemic times. But now in a pandemic, trying to induct them into our system is exceptionally difficult. So it's difficult on them, but it's also difficult on the staff who work all the time on the floor. People are very, very stressed, and there is a lot of, obviously we're stressed, we're prone to COVID also, and we all have lives outside of our working lives. So there's a lot of stress from every angle on staff.
Anne, I'm told you have 37 years experience nursing. Have you ever seen anything like this in your career?
I have never seen anything like this in my career. I have also never seen the dedication of the staff inside in our hospitals. They are under exceptional pressure. And I worked in the vaccination clinic on Saturday. I did a 13-hour shift. And to see the exhausted people coming off night duty at 8 o'clock in the morning, staying on until 9 or 10 o'clock just to avail of their vaccine, and the joy, it is absolutely remarkable. And it is a great testament to the people that are working on the front line.
And while that resilience is remarkable, it also emerged this week that some health staff deemed close contacts, but who are not showing COVID-19 symptoms, have been called back to work. Yesterday, Cork University Hospital had the second highest number of COVID patients after Limerick. And Dr. Conor Deasy from Cork spoke on Morning Ireland about the pressure they were under.
Basically, every patient and colleague in the hospital right now potentially has COVID. That's the mindset that we have. So we're on our guard all the time, wearing full PPE for all patients, not just those known to have COVID. And this is tough for patients. It's much harder to establish a rapport with somebody wearing a mask, a visor, long sleeve gown and gloves. And from the healthcare professional's point of view, it takes a lot more effort to communicate words, not to mind emotions.
The pinch point we heard from Beaumont yesterday in this third wave is having enough healthy staff available to meet the pressure you're under at the moment. How's that working for you in terms of staff being sick, staff being contacts, and also staff being plain exhausted?
Yeah, look, that's an ongoing dynamic issue that we're managing hour by hour. There's, at any given time over the last 10 days, there was between 100 and 200 nurses having to be out because of having been a contact with COVID or having caught COVID. And similarly, you know, there's in and around 40 doctors out. So we've had to completely change how the doctors in training work within the hospital. So now, instead of being attached to a consultants team who might have patients on different wards throughout the hospital, the doctor in training is attached to a ward and must stay on that ward and tend to those patients. Some surgeons have had to be redeployed to medical wards. And you might say, well, what's the big deal? Like, they're doctors. But in truth, that's like asking a hurler who normally plays in the full back line to play in the full forward line. It's very different work for them. And we're all having to be agile, flexible and adaptable.
And this is going to get worse for at least a week or two before it gets better, listening to the NPHET briefing.
It certainly is going to get worse. We're anticipating and planning for an increase in those needing critical care here in the coming days. And we've seen it all this week. We've seen a real step up in the criticality of the patients and how sick the patients are in terms of their their lung function. So over the coming days, we are needing all hands on deck.
And on Thursday, Clare spoke to the president of the Intensive Care Society of Ireland and consultant at the Mater Hospital, Coleman O'Loughlin.
Clinically and professionally for you, I mean, it must be odd, I'm not sure if that's the right term, to see so many patients in ICU with the same condition.
It is unique, you know, to see 170 odd patients in your ICU with the same disease is absolutely unique, and it's you have to pinch yourself from time to time to actually believe that's true. There is the odd kind of, as I say, academic side to everybody working in this industry that's kind of their interest is piqued by all of this, but it's extraordinarily challenging. It's fatiguing, you know. It's sometimes hard to pick the emotion to attach to what we see, but the relentlessness of this virus and the relentless of ambulances pulling up to the hospital with people, a lot of whom are gasping for breath. To see so many people in an emergency department in the wards gasping for breath, it's very hard to comprehend, and it's very hard to put it all together. Unique, scary, but there's certainly, and I think it's reported in the news, a level of stress amongst the staff, but I'd have to say also there's a huge amount of resilience in the staff, and there's a huge amount of solidarity in the staff to pull together.
Coleman O'Loughlin with Clare, and for the rest of us, solidarity by sitting in. Over on Mooney Goes Wild, when good bird song goes bad.
I was looking at John B. Keane's The Field with Richard Harris in it on film the other night. And when it came to a night scene, what did they play? Only the too-wit-too-woo of the tawny owl, which is never heard in Ireland. It always kind of damages night scenes, Irish night scenes, when you hear this impossible sound there. But it too-wit-too-woo, one part of it, I can never remember where it's the too-wit part is made by the male and the whoo part is made by the female. But apparently it's a duet, a seamless duet.
Yes, that's right, and it's a really interesting sound, and I'm with you on that. It's a real bugbear of mine when this sound is put into Irish drama series or programmes like that to set nighttime atmosphere, because, yes, it's a sound that's alien here. Another one that fits the bill there as well that really gets on my nerves is when people put it in the sound or the song of the Great Northern Diver into all sorts of scenes where it doesn't belong. The Great Northern Diver does visit us in the winter months here in Ireland, but it doesn't breed here. They have a very haunting, mournful kind of cry that echoes across the lakes in northern Canada and places like that where they nest. But I've heard it on so many TV programs and films that are supposed to be set, you know, in the Amazon rainforest or, you know, in the desert or on small islands. So sometimes, yeah, when you get to know bird song and bird sounds, it does ruin a lot of films for you, unfortunately.
I suppose, in fairness to our listeners, we might as well let them hear at this stage the Great Northern Diver that you refer to there, Niall, just so they'll know the bird you're speaking of. So this is the Great Northern Diver.
You hear that there? That's a really atmospheric, mournful kind of call. It's used in lots and lots of horror movies. So that's one that a lot of people would have heard before, sort of setting that sort of unsettling but still mysteriously beautiful kind of sound. It's a species that's known in the English-speaking parts of North America as the common loon. So on the other side of the Atlantic, it's known by a completely different name, but to us, it's the Great Northern Diver.
And now we let you hear the tawny owl Richard was referring to earlier, which popped up in the field.
Mooney Goes Wild with little nuggets to fascinate and maybe irritate your friends if you're watching telly this weekend. Now, it might not have seemed it, but there were moments of hope and even crack on the radio this week. Yes, crack, goddammit. Okay, maybe with a small c, but hell, we will take any bit of bright going.
What will we do with the drunken sailor? What will we do with the drunken sailor? Early in the morning.
Oh, throw him overboard, maybe? Ryan Tubrity. Don't think I didn't hear that. But if you're hip to the groove, you will know that sea shanties are all over TikTok.
It turns out lamenting being stuck on a whaling ship while running out of rum is the favoured mood for the first week of 2021. Where's the rum? And at the centre of all of this is a guy, he's 26, he's a postman from Scotland, and he did a rendition of a New Zealand folk song called Wellerman. Million views on TikTok. It's in loads of other people's TikToks, things, stories. And this tells the story of whalers waiting on a resupply ship. Can you imagine? I mean, a TikTok sea shanty sounds like this.
She had not been 2 weeks from shore when down on her a right whale bore. The captain called all hands and swore he'd take that whale in tow. Soon may the weatherman come to bring us sugar and tea and rum. One day when the tonguing is done, we'll take our leave and go. Before the boat had hit the water, the whale's tail came up and caught her hand to the side, her pinned and fought her when she dived down low. Soon may the weatherman come to bring us sugar and tea and rum. One day when the tonguing is done, we'll take our leave and go.
Well, you know what? That sounds pretty good to me. I like that. It's kind of like a barbershop quartet, but on a boat and with more heads. And it's good. So that's a sea shanty. It's doing the job. How about this?
What will we do with the drunken sailor? What will we do with the drunken sailor? What will we do with the drunken sailor?
Have him arrested. Go.
Way, hey, that's your license. Way, hey, that's your license.
In the morning,
shave his belly with a rusty razor, shave his belly with a
sore
rusty razor, shave his belly with a rusty razor, early in the morning.
This pandemic is throwing up the oddest of things. And Ryan cropped up again, but this time from the archives, courtesy of Bowman on Sunday, in the company of Tim Severn, who crossed the Atlantic to recreate the Brendan voyage.
The decision was made to replicate the original craft as it would have been constructed in the 6th century. It was akin to a large curragh.
If you can imagine a dingle curragh scaled up, she was 36 feet long, 8 foot broad, and like a leather banana.
A leather? Okay, that's a very vivid picture. Cowhide.
Yeah.
How does cowhide smell, as a matter of interest, when you get into it?
Pretty awful, because we used cowhide prepared in the medieval way, which means soaking it for months on end in oak bark. And then we rubbed lanolin, sheep wool grease, into it. And the combination was pretty stomach-turning as far as smell's concerned.
And Severin spoke about the thrill of riding the waves and the fear.
There were terrifying times. Between Iceland and Greenland, we ran into very heavy weather which lasted for about 3 or 4 days. The really frightening times were at night, a very heavy sea running, and you're in a small open boat. It's very black, and all you can hear is the big wave coming down behind the boat. The boat was running for its life at that stage. And it's like an express train. And then it comes out of the darkness, toppling. It's way up there like a sort of cliff behind you, white rim on the top, which comes crashing down on you. The boat gets hit. It's surging water all around you. And then you survive. And a few seconds later, you hear the next one coming, and it goes on and on. That is frightening, and I firmly believe that if people aren't frightened, they shouldn't be out in a boat in those conditions, because it certainly sharpens your attention.
Oh, I'd imagine that's quite the understatement. That was Tim Severn, as heard on Bowman on Sunday. Edie Roach spoke to Brendan last Saturday. She's mad for the rowing, it seems. And while she's not a fan of lockdown, who is? She was looking skyward and to spring.
You've been a ball of energy in perpetual motion for so many years now. Is it hard to stop?
God. Brendan, can I sing that one to you?
Great.
I have to say, I had definite problems in the cocooning thing. But I am this person who, for all of my married life since 1977, I have actually been nomadic. All of a sudden, halt to the gallop, left with myself, I myself and me, was pretty scary. Brendan, I swear to God, I was like a caged animal. And that's the only way I could describe it. I found it extremely difficult. But, you know, the thing is, I've kind of adjusted to it. And this idea of surrendering, I got this idea from a friend of mine. And that actually is a beautiful word. And once I started that sense of surrendering, handing it over, what will be, and all will be well. And then I started to focus on that beautiful, most enabling gift of all, the gift of hope. I just said, focus on that, the power of what's possible. and then seeing the vaccine movement, all of the people around the world that have come together, not divided, not separated by race or colour or, you know, political background, but uniting as a wonderful force, showing us that how wonderful we are as a species when we put our minds to something, how focused we can be to help one another. And that gives me the reassurance for humanity, because we are the same human family. You know, like, we may be different in beliefs or in colour or ethnicity, but we are the same human family, and we only have one planet called Earth, and it is our task to protect it for future generations.
Okay.
And in a sense, you know, the pandemic has given us an opportunity to reevaluate and to relook at our own values.
Oh, warm and wise words from A.D. Roach with Brendan. And on Morning Ireland, Anya too was looking for reasons to be cheerful.
It's January. It's cold and it's grey. We're locked down in the middle of a raging pandemic.
We did say cheerful, Anya. Come on.
Have you noticed? There's a grand owl stretch in the evenings. Wouldn't that cheer your heart? And here's the man who's given the owl stretch a loyal Twitter following, Eivear O'Hanlon. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
How did the Grand Isle stretch end up online?
Every day at sunset, I have a little Twitter bot posting the size of the Grand Stretch in the evening all through the year.
And does it cheer you up?
Well,
the
I
Owl Stretch.
Personally get
yeah.
The Owl Stretch itself. Yes, I do. There's always it's always great to be coming into the new year and just to see the evenings get brighter and the feeling of the freedom that you know is coming later in the year.
It's funny, isn't it? Like, we celebrate the solstice. So many of us were looking at those pictures of Newgrange online this year, and we were lucky. There was a couple of days when you could actually see the sunshine. So even in, you know, these times of Twitter and all the rest, we're still looking at the skies. We're still looking for the sunlight.
That we are. Well, that's almost it for this week's playback. Not the easiest of weeks on the radio, but an important one, and hope for brighter days ahead. Come on, the spring. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.